do that, but I did try to provide as much as I could on the slides, and maybe hard for you to read a few of the slides, but hopefully you'll get it. So what I've given this title, and this really goes for this whole chapter, is The Sands of Time Are Sinking. Actually, it's based upon an old Christian hymn. And the idea is, and you can see I got the hourglass image there. It's the idea that time is, the sand is kind of going through the hourglass. And so the sands of time, they're slowly, slowly going through. And so we have an opportunity this morning to think about time. This visual you see here, these are a bunch of the movies. There are more than 50 movies, pop kind of cultural movies, over the last 20, 30 years. I'm a sucker for time travel. So man is fascinated by going forward, backward. Well, what if I go back and meet my father or my grandfather? You see it in all kinds of media and movies, and it's, and every time there's something like that on, whether it's a TV show or a series, I'm just a sucker for it because it's always interesting. How are they going to unwind this? How does this go backwards and forwards? So man has always had this fascination, I think, for time. Even so much so, as you see this visual here, if you know anything about this cryonics, where they actually freeze you upside down like a popsicle, and the hope is just before you die, they can freeze you upside down or just at the point of death and freeze your body. And so at some point in the future, maybe 100 years, maybe 200 years, they'll unfreeze you and you will somehow have science or artificial intelligence, AI, that can figure out how to cure you and make you maybe live forever. So man is fascinated by this. And this, we've got guys that are spending a couple hundred thousand dollars to be frozen like a popsicle. And I think it will do them no good. This is a program called Don't Die. It came out in January. Again, this fascination. This is a guy, the man who wants to live forever. So it was a Netflix deal. And I thought, well, I know I'm going to preach on time here in a bit. And I thought, I'll just watch the first episode. It's kind of fascinating. This guy is like a billionaire. And so he decided, hey, I'll make a Netflix series out of how I can live forever. And really, honestly, after the first one, I'm like, this, I get the point. If you diet, exercise, watch your weight, you know, those sort of things, that's the main thing. All the other things are supplements and all these other treatments. And his hope is he can, in trying to prove he can roll back the clock 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and hopefully someday live forever. Again, it's very futile, but again, it tells you that as a human being, we're trying to figure out how can we live forever. Well, here's a quote by Michael Kelly that I think is very well written. He says this: the precise quality of man's rebellion lies in its supreme aspiration to make nature, history, serve and glorify man. To accomplish that goal, he must have absolute lordship over time and its content. And that's what you see when you look at the media, you read novels. You can see there is that sense of man wants to be the one that's glorified and lives forever. Just a little review going back, just a reminder about Solomon and what we're reading here in Ecclesiastes. It says we're now at the end of his life, having returned to the Lord after years of disobedience from 1 Kings. He's already received the prophecy of God's discipline on him and his kingdom. Adversaries now are challenging his rule. He's soon going to die. The kingdom will be divided. And finally, despite his failures, God's control over circumstances remained comprehensive. So what I want you to get here is this is a time at the end of his life where probably he's writing this. It's being written about this, about the time we hit chapter 3. And so again, there's a lot of thought going into what's going on here. Here's the lessons I'm going to give. The first lesson, and Mr. Ostrand would have hit this, but I want to back up for just a minute. It's just a little bit of a way of review, but you can actually break up four lessons in chapter 3. So that's what I want to do for you. And so this first one you see is God's control over time. It's comprehensive. It's complete. There is an appointed time for everything. And you can see the hourglass there represented again. So I know Mr. Ostrand covered these verses. And it's fascinating when you look at this, a time to birth, a time to die. All the way at the bottom, it says a time for war, a time for peace. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, two verses to 8. You can see this is an album cover of a group called The Birds. This is the first time I ever heard these lyrics from Ecclesiastes. I was 9 years old. This was the pop hit, 1965, actually written by Pete Seeger in 62. But what he did is, there was a time in the Vietnam War, and you know, everybody was like, hey, we need to have peace. And so he actually looked at Ecclesiastes, and he took this, made it a hit song. And mostly, if you look at the last line, a time for war and a time for peace, that's why it was kind of selected. And so this is, of all the pop songs that have been written, this has the essentially the oldest lyrics. So there's a little bit of trivia for you of any pop song, because it goes all the way back to Ecclesiastes. Another interesting tidbit about Pete Seeger, the songwriter, is he only took 5% of the royalties. He gave the rest to peace movements because he said he only added about 3 words to the song, basically just copied out of Ecclesiastes. So you rarely see this happen, but I remember as a kid hearing that song, and I just liked the tune. I had no idea what it was about, but I know Mr. Ostrand was helpful. And here's what Barrick says in his commentary on Ecclesiastes. He says, what is the point of this description of time-oriented events? It is nothing happens haphazardly. No chance, no fate governs the things that happen in the lives of God's people. He controls all events. And so that's a little bit of a recap. So the second lesson is this, and this is what we're going to deal with today. God's control over time is appropriate. So this is Ecclesiastes 9 through 13. And the idea is he has made everything appropriate in his time. Everything appropriate in his time. So this is going to come, look at 9 and 10. He says, what profit is there to the worker from that which he toils? I have seen the tasks which God has given the Son of Man with which to occupy themselves. So this is the idea. Again, you don't have to write this all down, but if you want these notes later, I'll get them to you. It's a cyclical nature under God's very meticulous control, and it leads Solomon to ask this, you can call it a provocative question, what advantage does man have in all his work which he's done under the sun? And you could go all the way back to chapter 1, verse 3, because again, he's asking that again. So what's the advantage for man? What does it profit a man if everything's been determined? Commentator Walt Kaiser says this, all life unfolds under the appointment of divine providence. Birth, death, growth, harvest, joys, sorrows, acquiring, losing, speaking up, being silent, war, and peace. Since everything has its time from God, all the labor of a person by itself cannot change the times, circumstances, or control of events. So that might be an unfamiliar word for you, providence. That's actually the name of the church I attend, Providence Bible Church. I remember when my son, he started a church about 10 years ago. We're talking about names of the church, and he really liked Providence Bible Church. And I was like, Josh, I don't think anybody's going to understand there's a Providence University. I don't know that a lot of people understand Providence. And so I remember in the beginning, I wasn't a fan of it, but then the more I thought about it, the only reason we exist as a Bible church today, as I look back, is God's providence. I can't say we had this scheme, this plan. I can't say we were exceptionally gifted. It's simply, I look back and I go, this is God's providence. I can't always explain it. I just know this is what God wanted in our lives. Let's look at verse 11. He has made everything appropriate in his time. He has also set eternity in their heart. Yet so that man will find out the work which God has done from the beginning, even to the end. So what Solomon's kind of doing is he's raised the question in verse 9, also back verse 1, 3. So he's raised that question of what does it matter? What does it really matter? And so now he's answering this, and he's the question that's been raised, and the response, because the temptation is cynicism, right? He's saying it's appropriate. The Hebrew word here is actually the word beautiful. Some of your translations may have beautiful instead of appropriate. It's not the idea of the outer beauty. It's the idea that it's beautifully put together, that all of life's circumstances, they're fit together. They're wisely orchestrated. It is appropriate. And this is going to help us as we go through chapter 3. Solomon's answer reminds me, it should remind you of Romans 8:28, which says, and we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purposes. In having coached basketball here, this is one of my favorite verses because there's not a season that you go through, whether you're volleyball, football, or basketball, where somebody doesn't get hurt, injured, put on the bench because they didn't play well. Circumstances happen all the time. In fact, I remember one mother asking me, Gordon, what value is there in sports? Like, why should a Christian school even do sports? Well, one of the answers I gave her is, it's a learning, growing experience. And I think what you can learn is this, that we know that God causes all things to work for good. And so when you're going through a tough trial, a hard circumstance, you have the opportunity to grow in your faith. And that's a wonderful thing. And sports is kind of that laboratory where all of a sudden, before you get out in the adult world and you have a job and you see what goes on in the adult world, like, hey, I don't know if I can handle this. You have the opportunity, and almost a laboratory experience doing sports where you're competing against other people and there's setbacks and there's trials and there's good things. God can use that, and you can begin to see God's purpose in all of that. And that's going to serve you for the rest of your life, whether you're 10 years old or you're 80 years old. Even this last week, I had a grandson who broke his arm. So he's 10. He's trying to figure out, Grandpa, I broke my arm. I can't do basketball for a few weeks. Let's talk about it. I talked to a lady at church. She's 80 years old. She's probably got less than a year to live. So again, you're talking to old people, young people, and everything in between, trying to understand how God operates. But if we can come to understand that he works all things for good according to those to his purpose. Then verse 11, he has made everything appropriate in his time. He's also set eternity in his heart. So let's talk about that. So that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning to the end. So at some point, God has placed in all of us the desire to know all of God's plans and how they fit together. So it's in our hearts. I mean, that's why people are fascinated with time travel and what's going to happen. And you probably have seen this on TV too. There are people who are fortune tellers. Why in the world would anybody go to a fortune teller and waste their money, right? Well, they want to understand. They want to understand what's going to happen. So that's actually, God has put that in our heart. That's there. But what we need to be able to see is that we're not going to know the beginning from the end. Only God's going to understand that. Solomon acknowledges this. But the understanding is it's beyond man. God has kept it appropriately hidden. So the purpose, and this would be a mystery. So we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know what's going to happen next week. What can we take out of this? Well, I'll tell you two things. Is one, it teaches two things. It teaches humility and faith. We're not God. And if you think about it, if I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, if I don't know what's going to happen next week, I ought to be a little bit humble, right? I should, because I'm not God, and it's going to require some faith on my part to go through whatever I have to go through next week, next year, the next 5 years. Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and 13 says, I know that there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks see good in all his labor. It is a gift of God. So this is what you'd call a carpe diem, seize the day. That's a Latin term, seize the day. It's the idea that make every moment count. It's also in 3:22. And this is the idea that submission to God's complete or comprehensive control and an acknowledgement that it is appropriate are reflected in three things. And these are really important. So I would jot these down or get the slides later. But number one, an appreciation for God's rule. Number two, obedience to God's commands. And then finally, gratitude for God's gifts. Those are really, really critical. So one's lifetime is a set of circumstances that God has ordained. And so that's back to 2 through 8. So the gift of God. God has not given man the understanding of eternity, but he has given man things to enjoy in this life, which he is not worthy of. So this is exactly opposite to the typical response that a lot of people have when things don't go their way, which is frustration and fatalism. So you find this a lot in society where people are just like, I just throw up their arms. I don't get it. I don't appreciate it. And what God's saying is actually, this is a wonderful gift from God. So William Barrick says this in his commentaries: the enigmas of existence can make people frustrated, fretful. Instead of fretting, however, we need to accept our limitations and enjoy those things which God has so graciously, again, that word graciously, provided us, those good things which he intends that we may enjoy. So this is the idea of enjoyment, not frustration, not anxiety. So this, I want to give an illustration here. This is Brian Buscini. He was the punter for the University of Nebraska this past year. He and his wife, Kelly, attend our church, and I've had a chance to kind of do a number of Bible studies with Brian and his wife as well. So 2 years ago, he felt a lot of pressure, a lot of anxiety. In fact, I remember traveling to the Colorado game, and I go to all the home games, not many away games, but since they were at our church and I was getting to know him, I'm like, hey, I'm going to go support you, go to Colorado. So I'm sitting with his wife, Kelly, her parents, Brian's first kick. It's one of the first games of the year. It's a shank kick. It's a bad kick. And I kind of look over at him and I see this look like, oh no, and not a look like, well, there'll be another kick and it'll be okay. It was like a really like, this is bad. And I thought, okay, I don't know if I want to sit with the parents anymore because this is kind of hard, right? The next kick, it was a pretty good kick, but it hit and bounced back almost 20 yards. So that'll just kill your average. If you're a punter, the margin of error is very slim for your average for the end of the year. So it just takes a few bad kicks, and all of a sudden, you're not going to be the top punter in the United States. You're not going to be the top punter in the Big Ten. You may not have a chance at the NFL. So all the pressure hits like a punter more than like a lineman. So if you're, it's more like somebody who's golfing. They feel all this pressure, like this stroke is really going to matter. It could be so important. And I remember that game just did not go well. It was almost like it snowballed, and like everything just didn't go well. He had actually three games like that, and it was all mental. He's got this huge leg. If you saw him punt, you'd go, that ball is just going up there forever. So he has the talent. God's given him the ability. By the way, he can also throw the ball a mile long too. Did a couple of fake punts throwing the ball. That was great this past year. But he really was, his coach was pretty critical of him. It was a tough year. So we spent January, February, March, April going through Ecclesiastes and a Bible study called The Handbook on Athletic Perfection to help athletes understand how to have the right perspective about sport. But you know what? A lot of this boils down to just what we're talking about here. Realizing God's in control. And though he grew up with a dad that constantly kind of beat it into his head, you're no good unless you're playing the NFL. You're no good unless you're the best of the best. And so he felt all that pressure, and it was like, Brian, you just got to let that go. You got to think about what the Apostle Paul talks about in the New Testament, of forget what's behind and move forward to what's ahead. Again, easier said than done, right? But after months of spending time in Ecclesiastes in the Bible study, it like all of a sudden it went off in his head, and it was like, I get it. I get it. Like, I should enjoy this. I should stop complaining, and I should just focus on what I need to do. So those three bad games, as this last season started off, he had a shank punt, and I thought, what's going to happen next? He's fine. Had a good punt. In fact, his punt average went up over 4 yards this past year. He's one of the top punters. He may have a chance in the NFL. And I'd go, so does God, if you're a Christian athlete, does God make you a great athlete? Not necessarily. He might be too short. Might be too tall, might be too heavy. But I am convinced of this. If you're a Christian athlete, you're committed your life to the Lord, I think as you obey him and you have the right perspective, you'll be able to use your gifts in a way that will maximize your talents. That's generally what happens. But again, don't hear me saying that just because he followed the Lord, he's going to be in the NFL. Now, he's got a chance, but it's a small chance. But here's what I know. If God wants him in the NFL, he'll have a tryout and there'll be a coach that sees him and boom, he's in the NFL. If not, that's okay. And we've talked about that. And I get that he'll be disappointed on the day if he doesn't get that chance. That's okay. God's in control. God receives the glory. Lesson three, God's control over time is everlasting. And this is from Ecclesiastes 14 and 15. And kind of the main point here is everything God does will remain forever. Forever. So now we're looking at verse 14. And verse 14 says, I know that everything God does will remain forever. There's nothing to add to it. There's nothing to take away from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. I want to read the psalm because I want to keep us on time today. But you can go back to the psalm written by Moses that it really repeats the same thing, that God is forever. It's the eternality of God, his sovereign control, as well as this idea that we're finite. We're just here and we're gone. As you've already talked about, I'm sure, earlier in Ecclesiastes, we're like this vapor. We're this mist. We're here and we're gone. So the fear is a reverent fear. And again, if you want the notes, you can look, you can get these slides and look this up later. But I do want to say this, the fear of the Lord is the, you can call it the affectionate reverence by which the child of God bends himself humbly and carefully to his Father's law. So that's the fear of the Lord that Solomon's talking about that's so important here. Then verse 15, that which he has already and that which he has already been, for God seeks what has passed. Now, it's a little bit maybe confusing, but here's what I think he's asserting, that God is the everlasting one. He doesn't experience time as we experience it. He never loses track of time, doesn't waste opportunities. He doesn't forget what's past or encounters anything new. In particular, although we may consider details of the past as like water under the bridge, a distant memory, the past, etc., he actively knows what has passed by. The affirmation here prepares us for what's going to follow in 16 and 22. But I want you to get to the main point is I may forget what I did yesterday or what I did last week. God's not that way. He's God and he does not forget. He knows exactly what he's doing. And that leads to this next lesson, which is God's control over time is righteous. And this is our last lesson that Solomon is trying to teach all of us. God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked. So God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked. So back to verse 16 and 17. It says, forevermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice, there's wickedness. In the place of righteousness, there's wickedness. I've said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter, and for every deed is there. And so there's a couple challenges, and this is the first challenge that we kind of hit, which is there's a presence of injustice in this world. And so a lot of times people say, well, that's not right. That's not just. So what does Solomon say? He says, he considers what is a universal experience. The substitution of injustice for justice is the very place where justice is demanded. Verse 17, it gives us this response, the answer. There will be a final reckoning for every matter and for every deed. So again, God being sovereign, or in other words, control of everything, does not negate human responsibility. It's sort of a paradox. It's a really hard thing for all of us to understand because we're human beings. So we go, so God's in control of everything, but man's responsible. There's a human responsibility. It's a paradox in that we look at this mystery and we go, I can't completely understand it. I can tell you why. And the reason is you're not God. And there are some things we'll not fully understand. We go back here. Here's what David Gibson, and when I spoke last spring, this is kind of, I mentioned this book, Living Life Backward. It's a commentary on Ecclesiastes. He says this, one of the ways we learn to live by preparing to die is by realizing that death means judgment. That's a good thing. It gives my present actions meaning and weight. It gives my experienced losses, injustices, a voice in God's presence. What is past may be past, but what is past is not forgotten to God because he's in charge and lives forever. One day, all will be well. Every single thing that happens will have its day in court. So let me try to help you understand this a little bit. So there are certain things that provide weight and it gets our attention and we know it matters. So when you play a basketball game, you keep track of who's ahead, who's behind, right? You want to know what the score was. Somebody keeps track. I love playing pickup games after my playing days. And so I was in Grand Island. I'd go to the noon game. Here's the funny thing. You got a bunch of old guys in there and we're all playing just a pickup game. And you'd kind of keep track of a score, but it's just a pickup game. You'd kind of lose track. And all of a sudden, you'd see somebody go, "What's the score?" And somebody go, "Well, I kind of lost track." And you could sense that it's almost like, I want to play basketball, but almost what's the point of it, even a pickup game, if we're not keeping track of the score? So somebody would always say, "Well, let's just call it 5-5," and then you kind of move on. And so even something like that, and there's not a time that I came home from the Y at 1:30 and my wife said, "Did you win the pickup game today?" Right? You don't do that. Nobody cares. But even within that pickup game, there was like, we got to give a little weight to this because otherwise it just doesn't matter. 20 years ago, I remember thinking we ought to have a record board for basketball. And I mean, several people said, "Well, who cares? What does it matter?" And I go, "Well, one sense, it's not what matters most, right?" But there is a sense that there's a weight given that if somebody excels at sport and has the most points, the most assists, whatever it is, you can celebrate that and it gives a weight to it that is actually a good thing. It kind of gets our attention. So when you think about Ecclesiastes, what he's saying, by knowing there's a day coming, there's a judgment, we don't go through life like this, what does it matter? Like it actually has our attention. And what David Gibson's saying is that's a good thing. Verses 18 through 21. I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they're not beasts. For the fate of the sons of men in the face of the fate of the beast, it's the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath. There's no advantage for man over beast. For all is vanity, all go to the same place, all came from dust, and all return to dust. So it's the second challenge, which is, it seems like there's a similar fate, right? For man and beast, it's like, well, they're both dying, they're going to dust. And so here's the implication, is the fact that man and beast meet the same physical end, the dust. So then the question is, where's the fairness in that, right? If we're all gonna just turn to dust, is that fair? And of course, what Solomon echoes is truth of the curse in Genesis 3:19, by the sweat of your face you'll eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you'll be taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return. But here we go, verse 21 provides a response to the second challenge. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward? Verse 21 is tough to kind of interpret, but best understand as a sincere question, who knows, what if? But it acknowledges the fact and it refers to this future judgment, 3:17, and it will be emphasized again at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes in 12. And Solomon will later expressly state that the soul returns to God. So that's your answer. We're not beasts. The soul of man will be returned to God. Verse 22, I have seen that nothing is better than man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot, for who will bring him to see what will occur after him? So here you go, another seize the day. This affirms the idea that God's impeccable, righteous, sovereign control, he issues another carpe diem, seize the day. Since God will judge every deed to that end, man is responsible to, this is a key word, steward his life, however brief it may be, appropriately to the present. The stewardship requires an enthusiastic embrace of one's God-given responsibilities in this present life. So you have a stewardship. And let me use sports again because I coached. And if you're not into sports, I'm sorry, but that's most of my illustrations. They don't let me preach at church very often because all I do is do sports illustrations. But here's a sports illustration for you that we need to steward and do the best we can. Many years ago at this school, I remember we had a volleyball coach and we had a very bad volleyball team, like maybe an all-time not good team. And I had an oldest daughter was on the team, and I think the coach was just trying to kind of keep them positive and like, let's just stay positive because we're just not very good. And I remember they played a game where they were terrible. I mean, I don't think they even had a good attitude. They didn't excel at what they were told. There's nothing about the game that was very good at all. And the game was over, and I remember standing watching the girls come off the court and go to the locker room. And the coach had a smile, kind of the cheerleader smile, like everything's great. And she was high-fiving the girls. That was a wonderful, most great, and I'm just like, I don't know, it doesn't feel right. And it's not that I wanted the coach to scream and yell and jump on the girls, but I was like, there must be some balance to this where you steward your responsibilities, that you should work hard and not just like celebrate when you've not worked hard, when you've not executed. And again, there's a balance to that. I didn't want him to scream and yell, but I thought, man, this doesn't feel right. But again, there's a balance to it, because when I coached, if we lost a big game, we would sit in a locker room and we'd be kind of sad. And we'd hopefully, what I would tell the girls or the boys, they said, by the time we get out of the locker room, you got a smile on, life goes on, we got to play tomorrow night. That's one of the great things you learn about sports, but you always should keep in mind that you have a responsibility as a Christian athlete or student here to steward the abilities, the responsibilities that God has given you to do your very best. So again, this is this idea of seize the day, seize the moment. Here's our wrap up. So let's hear from Solomon the preacher. These are some applications. This says the words of the wise are like goads. These should make us want to apply. So the first one, I've got five for you as we close out. The first one is cease, or just stop grumbling. Stop grumbling. And I've worked with college athletes, pro athletes, junior high. I'm working with my grandkids. Hey, I'm working through this. I've got 10 grandchildren. I've got, they're all live by me in Gretna. I take 8 of them to the YMCA about 6 days a week. And so I'm still coaching in a different way. I would say it's a little more like, recess, right? That was probably my favorite class as a student, was recess. So it's a little bit more like recess combination coaching, but I take 8 of them to the gym. I love it. In fact, the YMCA even did a news article about us, because they kept seeing me coming with all these kids by myself. And they're like, who's this old guy with all these, like, what is this deal? And what is he doing? Because they're all homeschool. So I just pick the time I want to go work with them. And so I work with them all the time. But what I notice is I'm always coaching and always teaching, because there is so much grumbling going on. And I'm just like, nope, nip it, stop it. And so, but this is one of the keys in life is, and this is what Solomon's saying, you think about your circumstances, stop grumbling. Number 2, you ought to respond with awe when you think about Ecclesiastes 3. I mean, God is sovereign. We ought to be in awe of God. This ought to stop us in our tracks and go, he's God, we're not. When I was in college, and later the girl that was witnessing to me would become my wife, I remember Terry said to me, well, I said to her, she was sharing the gospel, the good news that Jesus died on the cross for me, and that if I repented of my sins and put my trust and faith in Jesus, I could have everlasting life with God. I remember I said this to her. I said, look, Terry, my dad had suffered from kidney disease for 3 years, really a rough battle. As a high school student, I was separated from him. He was in Denver, Colorado at a VA hospital. I'm back in Lincoln playing basketball. I would talk to him on the phone once a week. And I remember at one point he said something like this. He said, you know, I've been talking to the Lord lately. And we had no religious background in my family, none, zero. And I'm thinking, what? Talking to Jesus? And I was like, Dad, put Mom on the phone. So Mom got on the phone, and I was like, Mom, what's going on with Dad? And she's like, well, I don't know. He was trying to shoot at pheasants in the room the other day, kind of loose. But here's the thing. There's a chaplain that comes in every day and prays with him and reads the Bible to him. And I couldn't make heads nor tails of that. I was like, oh, whatever. But I remember when Terry was witnessing to me, and I said, well, you know, if I could know that my dad was saved, then I'd become a Christian. And usually when you're dating, you try to, you know, be nice and to the other person, all that. And she just looked at me square in the eye and she said, you're not God. And I remember kind of going, whoa. And I thought a lot about that. And that was my first step to coming to Christ, is just to realize I'm not God. God is in control of all circumstances. And so someday I may know, and maybe he maybe he is in heaven. I don't know, but I know I'm not God, and that's God's business. And of course, the next step was to realize what a sinner I was, which happened a couple months later, and to repent of my sin. But that first step was really realizing that I'm not God, and I should be in awe of who God is. Third, learn to delight in God's sovereignty. So set back, delight in it. Realize, hey, if I know the girls play tonight, they play Friday. I'm hoping and praying you're going to get by the first game. But if you don't, God's still in control. I'm going to try to be here Friday for sure. I'm counting on that. That's what I'm hoping. But you know what? I know God's in control of that. And I'm going to enjoy and I'm going to delight that God's sovereign. And I'm hoping to be here Friday and cheer the girls on to a victory. But we should enjoy every moment and realize God's in control. I don't have to fret. I don't have to worry. He's in control. Fourthly, remember future judgment. Again, that gives that weight to it, that there's a moment you will be held accountable for everything you say and everything you do. So if you're unkind to your parents or your friends, if you steal something, if you do something wrong, there is a future judgment. And then finally, and I've hit this already, steward your time. Some of you know I work with Coach Brown at the University of Nebraska for a long, long time now. He's coached at Nebraska, and this is probably one of his biggest emphasis when he talks to Christian athletes and coaches is stewardship. Are you stewarding your time? And for the most part, we struggle with that. And some of us do a little better than others. But I think when you look at a class, Ecclesiastes 3, and you realize who God is, it should be a wake-up call that we should make the most of our time. And again, the Latin phrase, seize the day, make the most of your time. So even today, make the most of your time today. If you're a wrestler, make the most of every moment in that match. If you're a basketball player, it all counts. In fact, I still remember this, and those girls that play basketball will find this funny, but this was many years ago, decades ago now, but I think it was High Plains, and back then I think it was still Polk Cordville or something. But it's when the girls were really not very good in basketball, and we got better, and it was great when we got better. That was more fun. But I remember we were not real good, and being in this gym, I would watch the other team warm up. And they were giggling and laughing and throwing the ball up and just in warm up, just like, and I'm just like, there is a point of, you know, where you get a little more serious, right? There's a point for fun and there's a point for when you get serious. And I'm just like, I cannot believe my eyes are just goofing around. It drives me crazy. That was the other team. Now, the really hard part was they beat us, but I didn't like it because it was like, they shouldn't be able to beat us when they're just goofing around like that. Like, there is a point of where you go, there's a point for having a great time, for fun, and there's a point for, I'm going to run lines now, and I'm going to run them as hard as I can. In fact, I said to my 8-year-old grandson the other day, he said, Grandpa, he goes, when I run lines, should I run fast? And I said, Silas, you know who Sonic is, right? Oh, yeah, I like Sonic. It's kind of like the Roadrunner. I said, so when you run lines, you just think you're Sonic, and you go as fast as you can. And sure enough, that helped him. He's like, and that's the way you should run lines. Not like half speed, run it like Sonic. And so in some sense in life, we ought to run a little bit like Sonic. I hope that's helpful this morning, Bible teachers. If you want the PDF of the slides, just let me know and I'll get that to you. Let me close this in prayer. Lord, we are thankful for today, for these students. I pray for them, those that have competitions coming up, whether that's wrestling, basketball, music, drama, whatever it is, help these students really maximize the God-given gifts you've given them, whether it's in their studies or their sports, and steward this well for your glory, not for our glory, and let us enjoy every moment and seize the day, seize today, seize tomorrow, seize our future, make the most of it and enjoy it. We just pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.